Laudator Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Sister Janet Ferns. On today's program, we try to analyse why Zambian street kids stay on the streets. We also hear the second episode in the series about Cardinal Henry Stuart, Duke of York. First, however, we listen to two Cistercian monks who balance prayer, work, and peace in their daily lives.
When I approached some of these people, they thought, "You're really monks? This isn't some kind of California marketing scheme." And we said, "No, we really are monks, and we pray 5 hours a day in Gregorian chants and all of that." And he says, "So let me get this right. You want to provide supplies at a discount, and then you're going to take that money and use it for charitable works." And I said, "Yes, but there's one more good thing to our little story, and that's with every purchase, you get a spiritual rebate. The monks are going to pray for you, and I don't think your office retailer ever offered you that."
Obviously, our life is centered on prayer. Fundamentally, it's built around the praying the divine office, all the hours of the divine office each day. But then part of the prayer and practice is living in community life. And part of the community life is involved in being responsible for our own living.
But what, of course, is important for us is as you advance in the monastic life and religious life in general, you're able to begin to develop an interior presence, kind of an opening, so to speak, to that continual presence of God in the present moment. And whether you're mowing the lawn or selling an inkjet cartridge or, you know, feeding the dog or something, you can still have that interior presence, that interior cloister, if you will, that has to do with God's presence, even if you're not, shall we say, actively focused on some sort of official prayer or intercessory prayer.
Father Bernard McCoy and Father Timothy Kelly are both Cistercian monks called to a life of intense prayer and commitment to God. Yet their monastic life also means that Father Bernard and Father Timothy are busily catering for the day-to-day needs of their brother monks, and in very different ways. Father Bernard's monastery in Wisconsin, in the United States, has begun an online company for refilling empty printer cartridges. Father Timothy is based in Rome and is the Cistercian Order's Procurator General. Father Timothy explains his work.
My present position has put me into a place where I have to be part of the liaison with the whole church, with the order. I'm Procurator General, which is an elected office by the General Chapter. I'm the go-between the order and the Vatican and the Congregation of Religious primarily. So things that need to be approved by the Congregation of Religious or any other congregations, I basically carry the papers to the Vatican and make sure they get responded to in some way, shape, or form.
Father Bernard was also elected to his own position in his monastery.
I'm also what we call our steward of temporal affairs, which means I manage all of our various income projects and the various temple needs for the abbey. The monks have this habit of liking to eat twice a day, and I put food on the table.
Both Father Bernard in Wisconsin and Father Timothy in Rome live a similar life as Cistercians, a life based on their living in community. Father Timothy describes the way in which each day is a rhythm of community, prayer, and work.
Well, certainly our history begins really with the Rule of Benedict. We're really Benedictines who are reformed in 1098 and so on and so forth. We're actually a group of somewhat autonomous monasteries who are form this order, who more or less accept the same form of life and have some a common meeting at a general chapter every 3 years to talk over problems and various ways of relating to the wider world.
So because of the structure of the monastic life itself, for us, we get up the same time every day. We have our prayers interspersed throughout the day, and all of ours is in Gregorian chant. There's a natural rhythm that forces us to keep that proper balance, which, unfortunately, most people in the secular world, it's very hard to achieve. They don't have that spiritual structure that they live in. And, of course, we live in our monastery 24 hours a day, and our work takes place there as well. But for us, absolutely, prayer and our relationship with God is the priority. The work, Laser Monks itself, is there in order to support that, to keep us able to pray, and to keep us able to help others listen for those whispers of God's call.
Benedictines have, since they were founded in the 7th century, put together the ideas of prayer, work, and peace. The Cistercians continued this charism, as Father Benedict explains.
There's always that balance that has to be achieved in our life between the various works we do and our life of prayer. I think one of the important ways to answer that from our perspective is the Benedictine and Cistercian monastic life has a catchphrase, if you will, a motto, that's ora et labora, and then the word pax. The Latin words for ora, prayer, labora, work or labor, and then pax for peace. Our prayer and our work come together to bring about peace, both within our community and in the world at large. And what's important, I think, here to see is that we do not differentiate, so to speak, in our day. It's not all chopped up in the sense of it's 9 to 5 at the office and then the rest of the time is at home. For us, very much like Adam and Eve originally in the Garden of Eden, we have a productive, creative kind of work that is not only productive of fruits for our table, but the work we do also puts food on other people's tables, the needy throughout the world.
Daily life is concerned as much with the nitty-gritty of ordinary human living, just as much as prayer.
It is a very human life, and fundamentally, I hope we're saying that a very human life is also a life of prayer. That is the way we respond to God in our life. The creation, the world we have, is God's gift to us, and we must work with it, use it, in order to present it to back to God, you might say, somewhat altered, somewhat perfected, I hate to use that word, but anyway, somewhat by what we have done in trying to further God's creation.
Father Timothy takes this a step further.
Fundamentally, it's a life, and a life that we are responsible for, responsible for taking care of the community and ourselves, and all of that done in the context of a prayer structure, which calls us back, you might say, to that central desire of our hearts to be one with the Lord. But it fundamentally is a very human life, and with all the give and take that human life demands. And although monasteries are often painted as this idealistic place where life just is like the angels would have it, it's not. It's very, very a very human community with all the ups and downs of human community that call us to be share in the charity of God and in the patience of the Lord and all those types of virtues that any Christian needs to live by.
Community life is a human life, but it is one lived in relationship with God.
Very much the same way for monks in our relationship with God and in our relationship of prayer to the world. Even if we're extremely involved, say, intellectually with typing something, it doesn't mean that we're disengaged from being monks in relationship to God at the same time.
Cardinal Henry Stuart, Duke of York, was also the Bishop of Frascati and did much for the people of his diocese. Dr. Mary Jane Cryan describes some of his activities.
O God, what a blow! What anguish of soul for me to note in a pontifical brief, which must of necessity fall before mine own eyes, that by a stroke of the pen, as it were, I myself have been betrayed and deprived of the benefit of that maxim, which had been upheld by the Holy See with unswerving fidelity for upwards of a century. Under these circumstances, it would be useless for me to deny that the wound rankles in me.
Thus wrote Cardinal Henry Stuart on November 4, 1792. Impoverished, dependent on the charity of others, he who had been honoured as a prince in exile from his native Scotland and of England from the day of his birth. Within his diocese of Frascati, there were many who had had cause to be grateful to him and to his family.
A very important man in Frascati. He was a bishop there for 30 years. So Frascati is filled with a Stuart coat of arms and monuments, and the people consider him a great benefactor there.
But when he was bishop of Frascati, what sort of things did he actually do?
Well, he did quite a bit, I think. He formed the seminary. He opened a printing press. He took care of the education of a whole, not only of the boys, but also of the fanciulle and the girls. And then he made, every week or so, he went to visit one of the churches and checked out what was happening. And anyone had a problem, even if they had to be admitted to hospital or something, he would write the letters and give them the recommendation.
Cardinal Henry Stuart, Duke of York, was a pastoral man with a great love of art. He commissioned many works of art, but he never forgot that, whilst a priest, a cardinal, and even as vice-chancellor of the Holy Roman Church, he was also royal. When he first became cardinal, he was calling himself Cardinal Duke of York, and mm-hmm. then later, after his brother died, he changed his title to Cardinal called the Duke of York, which is an interesting description.
Because then he was considered His Royal Highness. In the diaries, he's also, scribe, you might say, this Don Giovanni, always mentions Sua Altezza, His Highness, or HRH, His Royal Highness. Letters were written to him, and he received letters with HRH always in front, because he considered himself a royal.
Yes, and I believe that once Bunny Prince Charlie died, some people actually called him Your Majesty.
Mm, then his name officially changed for the Royalists, for the Jacobites, to Henry the Ninth. Then. He was no longer Henry, Cardinal Duke of York, but Henry.
In 1765, when it became clear that his father James III and the Eighth was about to die, Cardinal Henry sent Pope Clement XIII an unsuccessful request that the Pope recognise his brother Charles Edward, popularly known as Bonnie Prince Charlie, as the rightful King Charles III of Scotland and England. The Pope refused, preferring to tread a path of neutrality between the Scottish Stuarts and the German Hanoverian claimants to the throne. Cardinal Henry protested.
Amidst the continual sorrows and bitter trials that my royal house has been decreed to suffer for over a century, two circumstances gave it, by way of compensation, a special degree of comfort and support. The first was the reflection that our every sacrifice was for God, for the faith, and for that unshaken loyalty we have ever displayed towards the primacy of Peter and the Holy See. The second was our own sense of the Holy See's devotion to our royal house, a devotion that began long before the days of Clement the XI. Although it was this Pope who in his glorious pontificate first absolutely refused to acknowledge any sovereigns of England, save those of our own legitimate Catholic succession, and came in course of time to regard such a policy in the light of a maxim of the Holy See that could never be abrogated. It was certainly only too true that in the reign of Clement XIII we were forced to drink of a bitter cup when we found ourselves negatively deprived of the royal recognition which seemed but the natural result of the decrees of so many former popes. But on the other hand, it is true that it was at that time clearly admitted as impossible to acknowledge any king of England whatever outside our own royal house, without breaking a maxim of the Holy See that was at once fully recognised, intact, established and irrevocable. And for a clear proof of this statement, it is alone sufficient for me to mention a custom that has never been deviated from, namely that in the public almanacs of Rome one finds under the heading of Hanover the account of that prince and his family, put with the greatest care, and inserted in such a manner as not to infringe in the least degree upon this maxim concerning my own royal house, of which I am the last survivor.
The protest was rejected. The cardinal was deeply hurt.
Since it has been dealt me by the hand of a father whom I love and venerate, and shall love and venerate while my life continues, I confess that I used to flatter myself that during these very few last remaining years of my life, my royal house would be allowed to expire in me without this fresh act of humiliation. But, inasmuch as we ought always to ascribe every event to the operation of divine will, it seems that I did wrong in resting so certain that the Holy Father would never dream of snatching from me the possession of that which in one sense can be termed a natural right, a right of compensation that protected me from many indignities. Now, as in consequence of this abjuration of a maxim of the Holy See, I should be obliged to suffer insult on any occasion that I might venture to enter Rome.
In fact, when the Pope invited the Hanoverian Prince Duke of York to Vatican, the Cardinal Stuart had to stay up in Frascati.
On the death of his brother, Prince Charles Edward, on January the 31st, 1788, Henry considered himself King Henry the 9th of England and the 1st of Scotland. He was the last of the direct male descendants of James the 2nd and 7th, and the last genuine pretender to publicly claim the thrones of Britain.
And he was such an important character that when he came to visit a city, like in Orvieto, they had to sneak him in the back way, and they had to use a secret corridors to get into the church because the crowds would come to see him. He'd be sort of like a film star of today, maybe, you know?
Was this because of his Stuart connection?
Yes, and also because he was the second most important man in all of the Papal States. So if the Pope is the top man, when he comes to visit, I can imagine the excitement around here. But when Cardinal Stuart would come to visit, everybody had to come and see him. And the English travelers who would come to Rome, that was one of the things they always mentioned in their diaries. Tonight we saw Cardinal Stuart at the opera. They would go to the opera, not to watch the opera, but to watch him in his opera box.
During the French Revolution, Cardinal Henry sacrificed his riches to help the Pope and was finally reduced to poverty when the French seized his Frascati residence. Old and sick, the Cardinal fled first to Padua and then to Venice. King George III came to his assistance and gave him a pension until he was able to return to Frascati in 1800. Cardinal Henry Benedict Thomas Edward Maria Clement Francis Xavier Stuart died on July the 13th, 1807, in Frascati. His funeral took place in the church of Sant'Andrea della Valle, close to St. Peter's Basilica, where he was later buried alongside his father and brother in the crypt beneath the main basilica. He had been a cardinal for 60 years and 10 days, one of the longest-serving cardinals in the entire history of the Catholic Church.
Every sacrifice was for God, for the faith, and for that unshaken loyalty we have ever displayed towards the primacy of Peter and the Holy See.
Now to the world of the street kids and the difficulties they encounter in their daily lives. Don't feel sentimental about street kids. Some of them are little criminals who are determined to stay that way. Some of them have already struck up an unhealthy racket with the police and security guards around the areas where the street kids congregate. I know, for instance, of an elderly German who used always to give any small change he had in his pockets to any child who asked him. One afternoon, as he stopped at the traffic lights, he told the boy who accosted him that he had no change that day.
In fact, the man was on his way to the supermarket and would have some money to give the children within a few minutes. That was not to be. When he parked his car and locked the doors, a security guard accosted him and called a policeman. In the few minutes it took for the German to drive from the traffic lights to the supermarket car park, the boy, to whom he had not given money, had called a couple of his friends. They called the security guard and accused the German, a very happily married father and grandfather, of having abused them in the supermarket toilets. The man was duly arrested and fined a huge sum of money, because the security guard and the policeman had their own little circle of corruption. The German? He was so heartbroken by the incident that he died shortly afterwards. Naboth Ngulube is a lecturer in psychology at Lusaka's University of Zambia. He is also involved in post-basic nurse training. He points out that street kids have an overriding need for money, a need that leads to all sorts of criminal activities.
Mostly they are begging, they do part-time work, they sell at markets, they steal, they engage in prostitution, gambling and other businesses. Earnings of these children vary. The atmosphere is ugly, but for the kid who has left home to survive elsewhere, this is life. This is hope. This is the future. But it's absolutely ugly for us, eh? Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, but the kid has survived. They make a lot of money. Money is the cardinal desire for those children.
Dr. Griselda Makumba is a consultant gynecologist and obstetrician at Lusaka's University Teaching Hospital. She adds that sometimes street kids are there because they are looking for fun in the absence of play areas and sports facilities.
Now, I find that probably one of the problems that we have is that there's no recreation of any kind for any of these children. And so some of them have made this as part of the recreation. This is why you are finding even the well-to-do children on the street. It's part of the recreation for them. Anything, any of these things, I mean, they are trying this and that. It's a time when they are trying to discover things. You know, it's certain stages of life, of that childhood, that they are trying to discover things. And so they try anything that passes by. And if we had, you know, recreation places where children would go for that recreation, a swimming pool, play parks or something like that. Indeed, you'd find most of them there playing. But now you don't have those things. They are just seated at home. What do you expect them to do? They will go on the street.
Yet the search for fun can also include desperate, practical needs that could be answered. I remember regularly seeing a boy begging at one particular set of traffic lights, and then, for a short while, he wasn't around. When he reappeared, it was obvious that he was bloated and extremely ill with nephrotic syndrome, a condition that can be treated, but untreated is fatal. Wanda Simasiku from the Nurses Guild of Zambia is involved in a project that tries to give some support to the street kids, even if the children themselves, used to the freedom of the roads, do not stay for long.
You'd like to know, I experienced this incident of a child who came in one of a program of empowerment called Creativity. And when the child was there, she had come to source for a way of living. And you'd be surprised, that was a girl of 18 years, who could not cook, who could not do anything of daily life. And, you know, I don't know how we are going to reconcile this, but again, on the component of Catholic Nurses Guild, in liaison with City of Hope, which is a sister's home in Makeni, there is a program that the nurses have adopted of incorporating some of these children into the normal life of a family. So what I'm saying is some of these children could not do anything. An 18-year-old child could not cope with this family. They looked at their children, they were doing everything. And this is a child now who's about to become independent. As we said, a child is from 0 to 18. Who is supposed to now have his own home and then maybe get married? What will happen to this parent? Today she's leading a normal life. She's got her own child and is about to get married. Unfortunately, she got the child because of the same problem of streetism. She had to find a means, and in the process, she got pregnant. She has stopped school because of economic hardships when the mother and father were both sick. So this child is now living. She's a totally different child after rehabilitation. Therefore, most of them want to go back to lead normal lives.
Naboth Nglube points out that the money earned on the streets has not been easily come by.
It's a hard end. There's a lot of beatings. There are fights every day, physical harassment. They are robbed. Some people rob those kids. Police harassment, sexual abuse, etc. What do they do with the money? They buy food and clothes. Some of it going to the parents, for some of them, right? This food. And they know where the children have gone. They buy food only in some cases. Some give all the money to the parents. And other activities, some are not specified how the money is used, food and clothes, and then back to parents.
The children often earn huge sums of money, yet on closer examination, a normal life is their dream, as Wanda Smasku explains.
They mention that most of the time they want this money for various things as we categorize them, but most of them want to lead a normal life. Meaning they want to be in a formal home, but they don't know where to start from. Some have gone to organizations, but these organizations have not fulfilled their needs, and thus they've gone back to the streets. But most of them want an education and a way of leading a life.
Dr. Makumba helps in her spare time to run two children's homes, so she knows the street kids from close contact with them. Yet it is not easy to help the children, as she explains.
Me, as a Catholic Women's League, we have actually a home for the street kids in the Kamala area, and we man that home. But sometimes we find that these same children, when you have brought them to the home, they go back in the evening, they run away and go back to that prostitution. You can imagine an eight-year-old going back on the streets to just for that prostitution. It's sad. It is really sad.
Those who are willing to help the street kids should come together and coordinate their activities, or else everything is doomed to failure.
I think all these NGOs that are there and they claim to try and help these children, I think they should come together and have one plan. All of them to have one plan, rather than each one doing their own thing. You know, it is like a maternal mortality with each one giving different names, and yet each one is trying to reduce the maternal mortality. But here, I think all the NGOs that are involved in the street kid issue must integrate. They must find a plan which they can all work together, 1, 2, 3, 4. If they are going to work separately, then it will not work. It's just money making.
And so we come to the end of our program for today. You can hear it all again in whole or in its parts if you go to our website at vaticanradio.org and click on English. I am Sister Janet Ferns. Until we meet again, may God bless you.